Welcome to the first episode of the Hindsight in Tech podcast. This is a podcast dedicated to breaking down and analyzing events or companies or products in tech, taking a broader, more insightful view in doing so. Part of the reason for something like this to exist is that most tech journalism and writing tends to be real-time, blow-by-blow coverage, sacrificing depth and insight along the way. This is not a criticism, it's simply the nature of the media business right now. Missing the forest for the trees, as it's called. This podcast, then, is dedicated to looking back and taking a bird's eye view to look at the forest. To be clear, this is not a history lesson. It's not about recounting a series of events that led to a particular point in time. There will be a little bit of that, but the aim is to analyze and think from a conceptual and strategy perspective. Looking at the forest means that we can identify themes and patterns, which in turn make us better at identifying the same while looking at the trees. On the scope of the podcast itself, it's quite wide. We could be analyzing a successful startup, a failed product, a massive screw-up, or just the state of a particular niche in the industry, past or present. To emphasize the last point, what's covered may or may not necessarily be something in the news. We might go way back in time to look at something interesting as well. This is a work in progress, so I'd be glad for any feedback possible. Feel free to suggest a new title as well. I'm not even sure if this one is grammatically correct. I'll leave my details in the show notes. So without further ado, let's get started with the first episode on AWS and how it emerged as Amazon's profitability machine. AWS in particular is a classic example of the kind of thing that I referred to in my intro. It seemed like it wasn't really a part of the media narrative about Amazon and nobody really gave it much thought, especially in comparison to the behemoth that is Amazon's retail business, until recently when we started seeing such stellar results. To give you an idea, around 10% of Amazon's Q2 revenue in 2018 came from AWS, but more than half its profits came from the same BU. So in other words, there's two parts to Amazon now, a profit generating AWS, where margins are great and Amazon is the market leader, and Amazon's retail business, where Amazon has wafer-thin margins, even more so given its obsession with offering the lowest prices, and where obviously, as we know, Amazon is the market leader. So essentially, the former funds the relentless expansion of the latter. Now, before we dig in a little deeper, let's first do a brief history of AWS. AWS, as we know it, began operations in 2006, but the BU itself is a little older than that in Amazon. Originally, the unit was formed in 2003, and it was devoted to helping developers integrate Amazon's offerings on their own websites, say offering APIs that let visitors to your website see recommendations and buy directly from Amazon. Around the same time, there was a lot of frustration amongst developers inside Amazon. Any team that was trying to prototype or test a new idea would often need to build things from scratch, and that too after being granted some of the technical resources required from a centralized controlling team that was calling the shots. Now, needless to say, this really slowed things down at the scale that Amazon had reached. Around the same time, the idea for the solution came, seemingly, from two different sources. According to a blog post by a former Amazon engineer, Benjamin Black, and I'll add the links in the show notes, his manager, Chris Pinkham, and himself came up with the idea in a paper. So Amazon famously does not do PowerPoints. They only do 6-page papers in their meetings, which they presented to Bezos in 2003. Now, the Everything Store, the book about Amazon, which is a gold mine if you really want to find out more about some of the early thinking and Amazon about lots of things, does not mention this, but does mention another inspiration, a book called Creation by Steve Grant. Now, the takeaway from this book for our purposes is that if you create certain fundamental building blocks, more sophisticated products or creations begin to emerge on their own. Now, Bezos was a big fan of the book and at the time, and it led him to understand that rather than having a centralized team decide what should or should not be supported with resources, making a bunch of primitives accessible to all would lead not only to faster development, with no intermediation, of course, but also to unexpected possibilities. Bezos said famously at the time, developers are alchemists and our job is to do everything we can to get them to do their alchemy. Now, work began after this, and we saw the building and subsequent unveiling of what are still considered the two core components of AWS, EC2 and S3. which correspond to the most basic primitives needed for building a website or an app, compute and storage respectively. The launch of these two services in 2006 leads us to Amazon AWS that we know today. Now, before we move on to some abstractions or themes that we're digging into, there are some points worth clarifying about the thinking involved in getting into this business. One common fallacy, quite easily disproved, is that AWS was built to counter the seasonality involved in Amazon's retail business. That Amazon's servers faced peak demand for only a couple of months a year, so it was worth renting out some of the computing power to other companies or developers for the rest of the year. This is not true, obviously. As Brad Stone puts it in the Everything Store, early observers suggested that Amazon's retail business was so seasonal, booming during the holiday months, that Bezos had decided to rent his spare computer capacity during the quieter periods. But that explanation is widely debunked by Amazon insiders, in part because it would require Amazon to kick developers off its servers every fall. Now, Amazon's current CTO corroborates this claim, saying that the plan was always for AWS to be a business as big as its retail division. Now, this statement might sound a little grandiose and all-knowing given how it was 12 years ago, but it's clear that Amazon intended for AWS to be a full-fledged large business and not just something to make some tidy money off during downtime. Now, the other point that seems to come up often is that one of the reasons that the idea for AWS came up is because Bezos was desperately looking for a different business that would have higher margins than the retail business. Again, as we'll see later on, this seems to be the result of a very linear sort of thinking, and was likely not how Bezos was looking at it at all. In fact, as we'll discuss later on, Bezos was willing to lose money for as long as needed in order to dominate this industry, just as he was beginning to lose money in the short term to dominate online retail at the time. Bezos might well have been looking to diversify, but it doesn't seem as if he was looking for a money-generating business to fund the retail side, which is how it seems to have turned out. Let's now dig into the meat of the podcast. This section focuses on some themes and abstractions and concepts that we can see from the AWS story. So we'll start off first with disruption theory. Many of you listening are probably aware of Clay Christensen's theory of disruptive innovation, and the rise of AWS and cloud computing in general seems to be a typical example of disruption theory. Back into the 2000s, let's say you worked at the server division of HP or Amazon, and you heard that Amazon.com, the website that you just ordered books from last week, just launched something called Elastic Cloud 2 that let you run your applications in the cloud for dirt cheap. Now, your first reaction must have been to scoff at the idea of this online retailer infringing upon your territory. Next, you'd mock the idea of any company running their applications in this cloud thing, primitive as it was. Unsecure and unreliable, why would any company want to risk moving their applications to servers that it had no control over? And then you'd hear that this Bezos chap was pricing it at a few cents for every hour that you used it. And at that point, you just burst out laughing. They'll never make money like this, the idiots. Of course. That is the crux of disruption theory. A shift in the market occurs, and new competitors enter the market. Early on, their offerings seem raw, imperfect, even primitive. And the incumbents who already have some very mature offerings and a stable business can't bother to take it seriously. But for some companies, the new guys' products are good enough, and they're happy with the compromises. In this case, AWS's early market was startups who were happy that they didn't have to break an arm and a leg trying to set up servers to even begin building their products. And the variable pricing not only made it cheaper, but more importantly for a startup, it gave them flexibility to iterate. Now, the incumbents, meanwhile, continue to mock these offerings even as they're starting to gain traction. But they aren't incentivized to get into that game because then they'd risk cannibalizing their own business. They'd also cut into the hefty margins of the legacy business with a business that seems nowhere as profitable. Over time, of course, the new guy's offerings get really good, and now it's not only cheaper but also better to use the new thing. And repeatedly, we see that the incumbents always miss this crucial fact that if they don't disrupt themselves, someone else is going to come along and do it. To close this point, here's a quote from Andy Jassy, who's the CEO of AWS. First, they said that no one will use it, then maybe only startups will use it. But they won't use it for anything real. Then it'll be enterprises will never use it. Then enterprises will never use it for anything mission critical. Companies and developers have voted with their workloads, and now competitors are in the spot of trying to spin something up. And you know, it's 6 or 7 years late. Another related point in Amazon's favor that Bezos was aware of early on was the company's inherent advantage when it came to running a low margin business. Now, typically tech businesses, that is, you know, product businesses that are either consumer or enterprise focused, tend to be very high margin businesses. That's part of their appeal for investors and entrepreneurs. Amazon, in that sense, was an anomaly in comparison to the other big tech companies of its time, with its wafer-thin margins and perennial loss-making. Add to this Bezos' customer obsession mantra, the company has always made sure to offer the lowest prices, thus cutting into its already lean margins. Now, what this meant was that Amazon was geared to run such a business. It even had a reputation for this. In stark contrast to Google and its free food and gyms and whatnot, Amazon offered no such incentives, and for a long time, their pay was sort of competitive. This is exactly the sort of thing that proved to be a perceptual moat of sorts for Amazon, as Bezos saw it. Now, quoting again from the Everything Store, Bezos believed his company had a natural advantage in its cost structure and ability to survive in the thin atmosphere of low-margin businesses. Companies like IBM, Microsoft, and Google, he suspected, would hesitate to get into such markets because it would depress their overall profit margins. A decade on, this is no longer true, of course. The whole reason for this episode is that AWS is now Amazon's profit machine. The cloud business has matured a lot and consequently sees much more competition. And the profit margins are pretty good too, as the tech has matured. Which brings me to my next point about staving off competition. Both the previous 2 points meant that for the longest time, Amazon had very little competition. As Andy Jassy says, I don't think in our wildest dreams we thought we'd have a 6 to 7 year head start, especially since we're across the lake from another big company in that space, and we all know so many people at each other's companies. He's referring to Microsoft here. Now, Bezos seemed very intentional about this. Quoting again from the Everything Store, when asked about the profitability prospects for AWS at the time, I quote, Bezos predicted that they'd be good over the long term, but said that he didn't want to repeat the Steve Jobs mistake of pricing the iPhone in a way that was so fantastically profitable that the smartphone market became a magnet for competition. It's hard to overemphasize the importance of avoiding competition, particularly in a platform business. It's so important and oft forgotten that Peter Thiel actually wrote an entire book about it. Before we move on, a brief interlude with some interesting stuff. Trivia of sorts that I found along the way. So this segment doesn't have a name yet, so feel free to suggest one. First up, Elastic Cloud 2, EC2, that's something that can be called AWS's core offering that every dev starts off with, wasn't built at Amazon's headquarters in Seattle. It wasn't built in a hotshot satellite office in Silicon Valley either. EC2, turns out, was developed in Cape Town, South Africa. Chris Pinkham, one of the guys I mentioned earlier as the originators of the core AWS idea, was planning to quit around this time and leave for home in South Africa. At which point, his manager at Amazon, rather cleverly, told him to go and set up an office in Cape Town instead and get to work on EC2. It just shows you that tech truly can be global. Next up, AWS has reduced prices in its services 66 times since 2008. It's a number that they occasionally tote around while announcing a price reduction. And while this particular number isn't official, but this is the latest that count that I could gather from their blog. Lastly, but not leastly, Andy Jassy, who's the CEO of AWS and he's been heading it from the very beginning, is quite an anomaly in that he's a non-technical person that joined Amazon after his MBA from Harvard Business School. Early on in his Amazon career, some engineers even refused to have him on as a manager because he lacked a technical background. He now heads a tech business that's valued by some at $250 billion. That should be encouraging for those of you in business roles in tech that have a bit of a complex about not being able to code. Back to our earlier discussion, the next thing we'll discuss is platform thinking. So AWS is a great example of a platform at a time when this thinking didn't come as naturally as it does now. Note that this was the classic definition of a tech platform, in that it provided a base for developers to build applications rather than the consumer hybrids that we see now, what Ben Thompson calls aggregators. That complicates the discussion and isn't relevant here, so we'll leave that for later. And so an engineer named Steve Yege makes an interesting point in an old Google Plus post about Amazon and platforms. Yege, who'd worked at both Amazon and Google, was making the point that while Google was better than Amazon at most things, Amazon did platforms better than Google. Google was at its core a product company, and that was the reason, according to Yege, that failed at Google Plus, because it simply didn't, quote-unquote, get platforms. In fact, Google's most successful offerings have been products, Search or Gmail, and now Photos. Android too, although the Play Store is a notable exception. On the other hand, Bezos realized the importance of platforms, and quite early on at that. He allowed third-party sellers to sell products on Amazon.com relatively early in the history of the company. And that's the same thinking that led to AWS. As we discussed earlier, enabling developers to work with the Amazon retail site was how the original AWS unit came about and eventually led to the AWS that we know now. Even the analogies used to discuss AWS show that they fully grasp this notion. Andy Jassy called it the operating system for the internet, and Bezos compared it to the electric grid, a utility that all developers could work with. Now, this sort of thinking is much more common now, almost to a fault, with startup founders building platforms where often one isn't needed, or simply misappropriating the word to increase their valuation. The benefits now are clear, though. Platforms can be far bigger than any single product can ever be, and unlocking those benefits is what every tech company tries to do. Then why didn't this thinking come naturally back then? Or even now? Why is Yege so annoyed at Google? I think at some level, it's a question of control and, frankly, ego. As I mentioned earlier, one of the reasons that AWS came up was that tech teams would often need the blessings and resources allocated by a central team, and this slowed things down. It seems a lot more obvious now when platforms are the norm, but going the platform route requires you to relinquish some control and, more importantly, a certain amount of humility to admit that you don't have all the answers. Thinking this through from first principles requires you to accept the notion that maybe you just need to be an enabler, and then people better than you will come along and create stuff that you couldn't even dream of. This doesn't come naturally to humans, it seems. Now, of course, platforms or aggregators, which are even better, are considered the de facto business models for unlocking the economic value, the greatest economic value, while helping you build a competitive moat that lasts decades. But this thinking didn't come as naturally a decade or two ago. Now, there's a lot more to discuss and analyze about platforms. A great place to start, as I mentioned, is Ben Thompson's Stratechery blog. Stratechery, I hope I said that right. His take on what he calls aggregators makes for super reading, and will probably come up in a later episode while discussing a different company. Moving on to a minor yet interesting point, AWS is an instance of what's called an emergent strategy, as opposed to a deliberate strategy. The most common notion of a strategy is one where you identify the field that you're competing in and then make a 5-year plan for how you'd succeed and what resources would be needed for the same. This is what you'd call a deliberate strategy. Amazon's deliberate strategy would be the plans that it made to dominate online retail and everything it did in that direction. An emergent strategy, on the other hand, rears its head over time. You realize that perhaps you're quite good at something, and then you discover an opportunity that you didn't plan on pursuing. Amazon didn't set out to be an enterprise software company. That was as far removed from its original plans as can be. But things fell into place over time, and it made sense for it to enter this business, and the rest is history. This is the reason why, while focus is very important for a business and in life, it also helps to keep an eye out for unforeseen opportunities and be flexible enough to experiment a little. Consider reading How Will You Measure Life by Clay Christensen on how you can apply this in your own personal life. That's pretty much everything that I wanted to cover. Before I close, there are a couple of other points worth mentioning which we didn't spend as much time talking about. First, there are some macro technological factors that aided Amazon. A rising tide to lift all ships, I guess. The most important one was a bet on Moore's Law, as well as rising internet speeds. The idea that hardware would get cheaper and faster over time, as well as the idea that accessing stuff running on or stored on this hardware would get cheaper, faster, and easier as well. This was one of the basic trends that precipitated the rise of cloud computing, and AWS's rise pretty much coincided with that. The rise of the cloud is a whole other topic worth diving into, so we'll leave it at that for now. The last point that I'd like to leave you with is about Bezos's long-term thinking. Every one of his bets is multi-year, spread over the long term, and that really sets him apart from a lot of other founders. A lot of companies use the long-term excuse for not showing a profit, but Bezos always seems clear about what track he's running on. I'd like to close with a quote from the Everything Store again. In an SD meeting before EC2 launched, Bezos unilaterally revised that being the pricing of EC2, to 10 cents an hour, as opposed to the proposed 15 cents an hour. You realize you could lose money on that for a long time, Van Biljon, one of the executives, told him. Great, Bezos said. That brings us to the end of the first episode of the Hindsight in Tech podcast. I'd be delighted for any feedback and suggestions that you have, either about the content or the delivery. I'm looking to improve all the time, so do send me the same by tweeting to me at Seeking Alpha. That's C-K-I-N-G Alpha, A-L-B-H-A. Do note the wrong spelling. My DMs are open as well, so you can message me too. I hope you enjoyed it. So until the next episode, here's wishing you a good day. Thank you.